WZRD Chicago. We have on the line Joe Jameson, member of the U.S. Peace Council's delegation to Syria this past July. Your report back is important for people to hear. We just heard on Democracy Now! This morning a piece about the White Helmets and the situation in Syria, and a continuation of the characterization of conditions there in such a way that quite a few people might be moved to believe that what needs to be done now is for the U.S. and NATO, but basically the U.S., to ramp up and intervene through military action in order to end the violence. Can you introduce yourself, Joe?
Sure. I work at I'm a member of the executive, but I'm a grassroots kind of a peace activist, and I coordinate the Queen's Peace Council, which has been around in one form or another for quite a long time. It's a coalition for peace and justice, and I've been active in the anti-war movements since the Vietnam era. I was a conscientious objector to the Vietnam War, and I worked in an alternative service as an emergency room hospital worker for a couple of years. And then I worked my way into the labor movement. Since 2014, I've been retired from the staff of the New York State Labor Council, having worked in such positions as research director and transportation union director. My background is transportation union. I was a journalist on the staff of the Transport Workers Union for in the late 80s and early 90s. So peace and justice really are my background. And responding to the first point you made, I'm glad to have a chance to speak to people in Chicago, because I would say our delegation, it's over, the dominant impression we were left with is how much the narrative that we are getting in the mainstream media and from the U.S. government about Syria is so at odds with reality. And that's what I'd like to tell people about, because we're entering a critical time and some crucial decisions are going to be made. And you're right, even people, basically good people like the ones who run Democracy Now!, are thoroughly confused. I don't blame any American for being confused about Syria. So we have to get the truth.
Okay, so who went on the delegation? And I think you explained why the delegation went, the necessity to get to the truth. Who went on it along with you?
Well, the U.S. Peace Council has been upset about and disturbed about the lack of action on the Syria war. It gets worse and worse, and yet there is very little activity by the anti-war movement. And so we appealed to all major peace organizations and minor peace organizations to join us on a trip, a fact-finding trip that would, we hope, reactivate the anti-war movement. So we did get, besides myself and one other member of the U.S. Peace Council, we got one of the leaders of Veterans for Peace, one of the top activists for UNAC, United National Anti-War Committee, various other peace activists, a lawyer whose background is work on the Palestine issue, an independent investigative journalist, Syrian American community leader. And so we were eight of us in all, and it was a very diverse group, people with basically progressive politics, but different backgrounds, different thoughts, different assumptions, and that's who we were. They were skeptical a lot, and we didn't take anyone's statement for granted or at face value, so I was kind of proud to be with such a group.
Did you pay your own way? Did you get money from the Syrian government? As if that should matter, but
we paid our own way. We requested the trip, and we negotiated essentially to get as comprehensive a spectrum of views as possible, and we did get a very comprehensive spectrum of views. But and the Syrian government did not resist any of our except taking us to the war zone. We didn't go to the Aleppo, for example, although we went to various war-devastated areas in the vicinity of Damascus. And it was as independent a trip as one could wish for. And so I could give you a lot more details, but we took us a lot of painstaking planning to have as independent a trip as possible, because we knew we were going to get pushback, or we expected we'd get some pushback when we got home. So the one viewpoint that one hears, left, right, and center, pretty much, is almost oppressive. And it's we're trying to come home, tell the truth, and do what we can to undermine the dominant narrative.
The dominant narrative, as I understand it, is that if one opposes U.S. intervention, bombing of Syria to protect the children, humanitarian actions, they're usually characterized as, that you're a supporter of Assad and the history of that government, as well as any number of vile accusations about genocide and war crimes?
Yes, that's quite true. I am even reluctant to discuss that matter, because our view at the U.S. Peace Council is that the actions of our government and the actions of our anti-war movement should not have to do with the characteristics or of the government that is, and the people that is being victimized by a U.S. Military action. Demonization, I may talk about demonization in general. We don't even have to talk about the Syrian case. But we're accustomed to, it's a technique of disinformation and public opinion management. It's been going on for a very long time. Let me just list a couple of names where the bad guy is the reason for the intervention. And the bad guy varies. In the old days, it used to be communist, Marxist, leftist. Nowadays, it's brutal dictator, terrorist, violator of human rights, violator of women's rights. So Panama, Noriega, Yugoslavia, Milosevic, Iraq, Saddam Hussein, Iran, the Ayatollah Khomeini, Venezuela, Chavez, now Maduro, Ukraine, Yanukovych, Libya, Gaddafi, Afghanistan, the Taliban, North Korea, Kim Jong-un, Syria, Assad, Russia, Putin. That's 11. That's what occurred to me this morning as I was preparing notes to talk to you. And it happens again and again, and the effect is to make to demobilize the anti-war movement, to turn the discussion to the characteristics of the victim rather than putting our effort behind stopping the aggressor. In many cases, when you go through that, you got left, right, and center there. When are we going to learn from history? I think we need to learn about this technique of public opinion distortion and manipulation. There are others I could talk about too, but why don't we learn? Why is there no learning curve? And I think the answer is why there's no learning curve is that each case is looked at in an unconnected way, because the pattern is there: demonization by the U.S. establishment, then aggression, then often overthrow. The pattern is evaluate each case on its own, insist, often with a great air of self-righteousness, that the victimized country must meet certain criteria that people in the U.S. have no right to insist on. Why are we debating, does the president of Syria live up to my definition of democracy? We should be debating, I will argue, and the U.S. Peace Council argues, we should stop the great powers, NATO, the European Union, the U.S., from crushing the last secular democratic Arab state in the region. Well, that's our basic philosophical take on what we ought to be looking for and what we ought to be working toward in the anti-war movement.
Going back even a bit further, when you were involved in anti-American war on Vietnam work, it was often characterized that you were abandoning the democratic forces, the peace-loving forces of South Vietnam, or there were the chants that William Randolph Hearst used in his papers, Yellow Journalism of that day, about liberating the Cubans from the Spanish and the right. Filipinos. And what comes out when people's struggle movements report on the continuing effects of the torture experienced in those societies by resistance to U.S. imperialism, and maybe you can explain to listeners what imperialism means, that it's well practiced, this business of using emotional language to mischaracterize people's good intentions and misdirect it so that they become complicit, or at least silent, and I guess silence is complicity in this case, in aggression.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. The as Professor Arts, Chicago academic.
University of Purdue, Calumet.
Right. He was spoke about this recently, and he was wonderful. He was going through, as a communications expert, all the history, the recent history of our government lying to us about wars. Remember the incubator babies in the first Gulf War? Total fabrication. Remember
the work of Hill and Knowlton, a public relations agency that works for tobacco companies as well as CIA agents.
Right. Remember the weapons of mass destruction?
Sure.
Remember the Gulf of Tonkin resolution? So we're getting a lot of atrocity stories from Syria right now. This morning, I was appalled at Democracy Now! When they ran this story about the White Helmets as good guys. But to her credit, Noemi Sheikh, the assistant to or the co-anchor of Democracy Now!, at least asked some telling questions. But there's an organized effort. And what's new, when I talk about demonization, that's the old traditional method, and it's at work in Syria, too. But the new method is to rely on NGOs, non-governmental organizations, and that's being deployed in a very prominent way in this war. And so building up the White Helmets, which essentially are funded by the U.S. and U.K. Foreign Office, this is documented, this is not my opinion, the work of Doctors Without Borders. There may be good doctors on the ground, but if you look at the leadership of that organization, very close to U.S. foreign policy makers. This outfit in London that NPR is so fond of quoting, the Syrian Observatory on Human Rights, well, it's essentially an outpost of the Muslim Brotherhood. So I could go on, and I'm not an expert on this, but we learned in Syria the extent to which this is going on. And we have to start talking about it because it's misleading our people and preventing us from getting to the main thing, which is opposing the U.S. regime change policy, which is the core of this war. There are those, there are progressive voices who say, oh, well, you know, the Syria war is nine wars. It's Shia versus Sunni. It's Iran versus Saudi Arabia. It's the Turks versus the Kurds. It's the U.S. and Israel versus Iran. It's on and on and on. Nine wars. Well, on that list, what's omitted is the main contradiction, namely the striving by the U.S. government to have dominance in the Middle East and to clear out of the way any government that offers even a relatively independent policy, like the Syrian government. And this is nonstop. You never see, it's never a government, it's a regime. Well, some facts. These are not my facts. These are UN facts. It's recognized by the UN. It has elections. The elections are monitored. There are opposition parties in the parliament. There are opposition parties in the government. It is, whatever may be the case with respect to all of the Syrian government's policies, I am not here to defend the Syrian government. I'm here to oppose the U.S. war. And I think we have to discipline ourselves to talk about what we can do to change the policy of the only government we can really influence, namely the U.S. government. And it certainly isn't to make it intensify the war. It is to withdraw the intervention, end the intervention, let the Syrians themselves decide their future. That's what they want.
Can you address the issue of civil war versus external attack? Because, well, that's often a key justification. It's a civil war that we need to help the democracy-loving, freedom-loving side. And the facts that support the U.S. long-term efforts to overthrow the Assad regime once it was unwilling to make a pipeline right-of-way available to carry Israeli natural gas into Europe to challenge the existing dominant energy supplier, Russia, to change the strategic political relationships and the arms that facilitate the violence that is taking place, which the Syrian government is defending itself against?
Well, two questions there, two very good questions. First, the issue of civil war or not. Let's ask ourselves the question, what's a civil war? You can have a civil war when there's a substantial body of people in a society who take up arms against the existing government. But this is not that. One of the astonishing things about Syria is how united the Syrian people are, not only along religious lines, not only along ethnic lines, but even along class lines. And that's why I say one of the great lies is that the Syrian government is at odds with its own people. That's what is asserted again and again and again, and it's false. The Syrian government enjoys the overwhelming support of its own people, including by its critics. There's a narrative about 2011, which is another false narrative. There was an opposition, a legitimate democratic opposition. It's still around, but it was having demonstrations against the Syrian government in the city of Deraa, and that legitimate democratic and nonviolent movement was hijacked by the forces that were trying to steer the whole Arab Spring in a right-wing direction, forces such as the Wahhabists, this reactionary form of Islam, especially reactionary form of Islam. There was the Muslim Brotherhood working with the states that are now involved in the war, U.S., Israel, and so forth, Saudi Arabia, Turkey, Qatar, all the rest. So that movement was hijacked, basically blown off the streets, and those people still exist. There is a criticism of the Syrian government from both the left and the right. The Syrian government is quite secular in its approach to Islam. It favors a socially inclusive and pluralistic form of Islam, not like the Saudi form of Islam. So it had critics among the more conservative religious people in Syria on the right. It had critics on the left as well. It had critics about corruption. It had critics about too many concessions to the big neoliberalism, the big IMF, World Bank. So it was it's a normal country. It was a normal country in the sense that it had a government that pursued certain policies and there were people disagreeing who were working through politics to change the policy. The war, what they call the crisis, has created a different constellation of forces. All these social forces are working together. So there is a democratic opposition, but some of it is in the government. The fellow who is the Minister of Reconciliation, Ali Haider, a socialist, he is the one who deals directly with the mercenaries, the terrorists, which is the word the Syrians always use. He retains his different viewpoints on social and economic matters, but he is carrying out the policy of the government on trying to achieve reconciliation. Just parenthetically, how many Americans know that the reconciliation policy of the Syrian government is that if some Syrian jihadist will lay down his arms, he can get an amnesty for himself, for his family, and be reintegrated into Syrian society? How many states if this is such a terrible government, how many states do that sort of a thing? I don't know any. Certainly wasn't done in our Civil War back in the middle of the 19th century. So there is a legitimate criticism of certain policies, but to turn that upside down and say, I'm going to withhold my efforts or weak or modify or mitigate my efforts to stop this war because I don't like that government. When we are victimizing, our government is victimizing the Syrian people. That's what's so shocking when you analyze it. I think in the course of my rant, I forgot question number two.
It wasn't a rant at all. I mean, the external attack versus civil war. And just this point, Wesley Clark, former high-ranking Pentagon official, a general in the Army, commented shortly after the terrorist attacks of September 11th that he had engaged in conversation with an active Pentagon official, a former subordinate of his, who told him that he had a report on his desk that indicated they were planning, they meaning the officials above him in the Pentagon and the White House policymakers that theoretically they answer to, were intending to attack, I think it was seven countries, Libya, Iraq, Somalia, and Syria, right, among that list. And they were going to do regime change and neutralize them so that they would have a passive regime that would be pliable to U.S. and Israeli interests. Much of this discussion that appears in the news rarely mentions the dominant aggressive power in that region, Israel.
Right. Israel is playing a role in this. I would say at the moment it's taking the form of its ongoing influence in U.S. Government, and the Israel lobby is well known. And then also it has, there are verified reports of it's helping, Israel helping the jihadis with medical treatment. They come over the border, get medical treatment, and then go back.
Return to the battlefield. It's not like they're helping them out of humanitarian concerns and then rehabilitating them and sending them back into the battle. They're not interning them. That's the word I was thinking.
Of course, there's intelligence cooperation and some other. But I think we shouldn't lose fact that the U.S. is the main player here. It's if the U.S. were not giving the green light to all these other states in the region, this war would not be on such a gargantuan scale and such a international test of strength. And so, and then I would say Saudi Arabia and Qatar ought to be, and Turkey ought to be the most, they're the most important proxies, although Israel is there too.
You know, it would have been over now. In fact, it was expected that the Assad government and the Syrian army would have fallen had it not been for Russia's active intervention. But it lasted, my understanding, it lasted as long as it did because of the solid support of the Syrian army, which is made up of members of all religious denominations who see themselves first as Syrians.
Yes, that's very true. That's why this is a national war. It is not a a civil war.
And their ability to fight off these the outside attacks that were supported by the countries you just mentioned and supported them with food, logistics, and arms transportation, infusing new recruits to the jihadi effort. Can you talk further about the people you met with beside Mr. Haider? Was that his name?
Haider, yeah.
Haider.
Well, we met with, we spent a lot of time with what we call the nonviolent opposition, because we knew that we'd have we were able to meet with various government ministers, but we knew that we would get pushback on that because the demonization climate here is so intense. But let me talk to you. We met with the women's movement. We met with non-governmental organizations that are doing aid to the areas that have been besieged. We met with humanitarian organizations. We met with the lawyers. We met with the business community. I'm a trade unionist, and in my life experience, I don't have too many friendly meetings with the Chamber of Commerce in New York or anywhere else. But we met with the Damascus Chamber of Commerce, who told us in great detail about the sanctions. And this is a lot bigger than what we are being allowed to hear in the U.S. The sanctions are very much like the sanctions against Iraq, and the U.N. said that 500,000 children were killed by the sanctions against Iraq. Essentially, sanctions shut down a country. They can't get imports. They can't get spare parts. They're usually accompanied by travel restrictions. Lawyers can't visit Geneva, where they could prosecute some of the arch terrorists. But most importantly, they can't get medical equipment. They can't get vaccines. So it's a way of destabilizing a government because you create social discontent. And as my colleague Madeline Hoffman pointed out, the sanctions in effect create a social base for the jihadis, the foreign fighters.
That's the hope.
There are some Syrians in the jihadis. Mostly it's 80% is the figure I heard from around the world. And I'll explain in a moment how that happens. But if you're desperate and you're being offered $100 a month, which is a princely sum compared to what the Syrian army soldiers are being paid, you have all sorts of temptations to join the armed opposition, and that's what's happening. Now, where have all these foreign jihadis come from? Essentially, the Saudis, who have deep pockets, have used social media to recruit Islamic youth in the suburbs of Paris, Belgium, in East London, in the slums of New York, in the slums of Chicago, in Toronto, and said to them through social media, if you get yourselves to Turkey, we will get you into Syria, where you can fight for Islam and fight. And in a world of Islamophobia and high unemployment, where young people, young men especially, have no hope and are living a marginal life in these communities, and they feel estranged from their own society, this has worked. So we have about 100,000 foreign fighters in Syria, and that's how this war is very much like the Contra war in Nicaragua. You have an external army organized by the U.S., paid for by the U.S., which is wreaking terror on the Syrian people. And I know a lot about the Nicaraguan case because my wife was in Nicaragua at the time of the Contra War. We know exactly what was involved. And so the Syrian people detest these jihadis. They've seen the beheadings. Our translator lost her fiancé 5 months ago. Our van driver lost his brother-in-law 2 weeks before we were there. So the truth about Syria is so different from what, and it's so tragic that even the alternative media buying into this, and we're marching off to war. And I don't need to tell you, it's going to get worse before it gets better, because we have one or the other of the two major candidates will get in January and probably pursue an even more hawkish policy. I'm critical of Mr. Obama on many questions, but to some extent he's exerted some restraint on the craziest elements in his administration.
WZRD Chicago, we're talking with Joe Jamison of the U.S. Peace Council, who recently returned from Syria. Go ahead, Joe.
Well, I think the reason I think it's a crisis and is that not only is there a humanitarian crisis, not only is there which is affecting millions of people, 5 million refugees from Syria, half of the Syrian population has had to move to escape the war-torn areas, moving, in, by the way, in the direction of the Syrian government-held areas. Not only that, but now, this is the new wrinkle, and it's the worst of all, the two biggest nuclear powers in the world are both doing saber-rattling, and we have John McCain, for example, in last week's Wall Street Journal, calling for a no-fly zone. Hillary Clinton has called for a no-fly zone, even quite recently. And so we have this war fever gripping Washington. And who is stopping it? Why isn't the anti-war movement, as it was in previous wars approached, why isn't it in the streets demanding no U.S. intervention, hands off Syria? That's the danger. And the danger of a nuclear war, I would say, is greater than it has been since the early 1980s. And yet we don't have a comparable mobilization against the threat of nuclear war. So this is not an abstraction anymore. And this affects, there are lots of Americans who say, foreign policy, who cares?
Well, that's exactly where they've been educated to position themselves. Not long ago, in fact, January, about John Mearsheimer was writing articles about his concern over potential nuclear war in Eastern Europe because of NATO's actions, the U.S. actions in moving weapons in toward the Russian border, as well as the overthrow of the elected Ukrainian president in favor of someone more supple to U.S. interests, and ultimately they installed someone with close ties to neo-Nazis, which further aggravated the Russian sense that the U.S. is a malign government.
And not a benign government, yeah.
Malign, not benign, malign. Right. And the end result is that Ukraine is an economic and social disaster, and the Russians have ramped up their statements that they understand, regardless of what the U.S. claims its intention is, that they understand the threat of attack that the U.S. is positioning itself in, an attack on the Russian leadership, and that they will respond appropriately to defend their society, which they have great pride in, unlike the Robert Kagans of the world, the people over the Brookings Institution, the neocons, the people of the Project for a New American Century, and the U.S. military Pentagon leadership, who think that Russia ought to take a knee before American imperialism.
Well, you're absolutely right. Isn't it pathetic that we've had this never-ending presidential campaign, which is dealing with the past sex lives of both candidates or their families, and
it's no different than the beginning of this country. If you read Aaron Burr by Gore Vidal, the same kind of cheap corruption and criminality and sexuality was predominant in this society. So the illusions that are foisted on people to think about the good old days, when even then they were talking about empire. So it's only worse now.
I guess it's somewhat comforting that we're about as bad as our ancestors. I guess that I can take a little bit of comfort from that.
Well, we're worse because the technology that's been brought into play through the exploitation of human creativity, ingenuity, the manipulation of people's aspirations to solve problems has created a nightmare of technology that will be further loose, is already loosed on the planet, but in the destabilization and destruction of global warfare will be the ultimate doomsday machine for life on this planet, let alone climate change.
I saw yesterday a very good article by a man I have a lot of respect for, paradoxically, Ray McGovern, who is what I would call a repentant CIA agent. He was and very highly placed. He, for years, briefed the first Bush president, and then Reagan, I guess, and then Clinton. The morning briefing of the president was done by Ray McGovern, and he just wrote that about this saber rattling between Russia and the United States, and that the Russians take this very seriously because their historical experience is that they've been invaded from the West three times in the last 150 years, and the last time it cost them 27 million lives. And so when the U.S. moves hair-trigger ICBMs to the border, as it did recently with the NATO expansion, they get scared. And so, and then the possibility of miscalculation is so great. I think we should get scared. Instead of, we have to, but the what we have to do is, I think, begin among progressive people in the anti-war movement and begin to work out from there, because it's tough, in this awful election season, it's tough to break through to public consciousness. But for example, here's one way. I was very much in admiration of the women of Code Pink, who are raising this question of the role of the Saudi government in spreading around this awful ideology that is so vile toward women. Where is that discussion? Where is the proportional concern about the lack of democracy of the U.S. proxies in this war? Saudi Arabia, Qatar, Turkey, the other Gulf monarchies, Israel, Jordan. Are these states perfect democracies? I don't think so. But why is the obsessive focus on the Syrian government when a simple review of the facts are that it does meet most of the legitimate characteristics of a democratic government? In any event, it's not our call. It's not our call. So that is one of the things that rankles me. I think we have to get our peace-oriented people like yourself and like me and others have to get our indignation levels up and be outraged by the so-called regime change policy. I hate that phrase because it renders our movement ineffective. People might inwardly be inclined to oppose aggression, but they don't because they don't want to be blamed for supporting the bad guy. There are many more than the 11 I mentioned. And so we have to have a learning curve, finally. We have to resist pressure. I'm very grateful that you're giving me an opportunity to talk to your audience.
This is WZRD Chicago. We're speaking with Joe Jameson, who accompanied the U.S. Peace Council's recent inspection visit to Syria, where they spoke with members of the elected government, members of civil society, members of the business community, activists, people in the opposition, and came back with a very different picture of what that society is about than the one that is portrayed on U.S. corporate media. Joe, can you talk about, since you've been a journalist, and perhaps you still are a working journalist, the way that messaging and policy promotion are used to falsely validate this concept of regime change, to falsely validate what usually turns out to be crimes of aggression on the part of the United States under the concept of humanitarian intervention. That may be out of your ballpark
expertise. I can talk a little bit about it. I'm not an expert on foreign policy. You're right. There are really two different streams of foreign policy thinking that are influential with the present administration, and that is the neocons, who have an obsession with Russia. And then there's perhaps even more is what you might call the liberal interventionists, or some people call them the humanitarian imperialists. And they're associated with the names of Samantha Power, who was our UN ambassador, and then her boss, Susan Rice. And this ideology has been evolving, and so what they do is they find some alleged humanitarian issue and focus on it one-sidedly, and or invent it if need be, and then that is used to justify U.S. interference in the form of so it's a form of what Hillary Clinton likes to call soft power. In other words, instead of sending in the Marines, which is hard power, you use the National Endowment for Democracy, or use the NGOs like the White Helmets, or use the Doctors Without Borders to demonize and then eventually overthrow whatever government you want to overthrow. So I've already mentioned demonization and the use of NGOs, but there are other, even the struggle over vocabulary. For example, the use of the word brutal regime. I was appalled to find in a book by somebody I admire greatly, namely Phyllis Bennis, who writes on foreign policy, she used the word brutal regime to characterize the government. Well, it's a rather selective use of the word brutal regime. Is the government of our president brutal? I think so. I would say so. It's a government that just authorized $100 billion for modernization of nuclear weapons. It's a government where assassination lists are viewed, looked at in the Oval Office every Tuesday, apparently. It's a government that has seven wars going on, but why don't we speak of the brutal Obama regime? So we need to have some proportionality and balance, and I think some of this is unconscious. Even the use of the word regime, I find myself using it from time to time, and then I correct myself. I speak of the Syrian government. So that's one factor. Then the way the atrocity, we're getting these atrocity stories now, and they're coming in a spate, and they usually involve children. Now, I don't think it's possible for all human beings are moved by the sight of suffering children. Look at that picture that went around the world last year of the Kurdish boy drowned in the surf off the coast of Syria, face down in the surf, and a 4-year-old, and then being taken away, I guess, by his father.
Well, there is one exception, Madeleine Albright, for whom 500,000 Iraqi children deaths was worth it to achieve her policy.
Now, that was appalling things I've ever heard in my life. But we have to recognize the nature of propaganda in wartime. And what is causing this frenzy of atrocity stories? It's not simply the military situation on the ground in Aleppo. I've already explained the actual policy where the Syrian government and the Russian government have opened up corridors to get all the civilians out. That will be scoffed at by the war hawks, but yet it's true. And the international journalism community knows that it's true. The American journalism community doesn't know. So you have that. But we have to bear in mind that because the U.S. is, at least at the moment, until perhaps there's an escalation, the U.S. is losing the war. And so there's a certain frantic desperation to intensify the ideological war when the military war is and another element, and you can see an example of this almost at the personal level, where Samantha Power, whom I've mentioned a couple of times, had a press conference at the UN. Now, she is normally a cool character, but she lost her cool the other day in her press conference and spitting tacks at Russia. So there's frustration in U.S. policy circles, top policy circles, about the war. And my own personal opinion, it doesn't represent anybody else's opinion but mine, is that the strategy now is to try to avoid losing Aleppo before January, because in other words, it's waiting for Hillary. That's just a personal opinion. I'm not associated with any you know, U.S. Peace Council position, but it's my cynical self commenting on what I see happening. So,
well, let me throw this in. There was a truce arranged between President Obama and the President Putin through their foreign secretaries, and that truce either lasted very, very briefly or didn't have a chance to come into effect to allow those corridors to serve their purpose, because the U.S. military proceeded to attack Syrian positions guarding an airport, a strategic airport, and killed 60 Syrian soldiers, wounded 100 others. That attack was then shortly followed by ground assault of jihadis to try and take the airport. The act of that attack, which was supposedly an accident, according to the U.S. and Samantha Powers, but seen by the Russians as something other, ended the truce and the negotiations. You have a situation, by my lights, that there's a constitutional crisis underway, as well as a threat of nuclear war. You have within the government, within the Pentagon, some reactionary militarists whose existence that have always wanted to go bomb Russia, who have proceeded to undermine the policy, foreign policy, of the President of the United States, the commander of the military, theoretically,
right,
and increase through their actions the chance of confrontation with the Russians. That's a constitutional crisis.
Absolutely.
And yet, where is it being reported outside of places like Global Research from Canada or Information Clearinghouse.info?
And I, you're absolutely right. And
the Russians see that. I'll finish the point. The Russians see that there's a constitutional crisis in the leadership. Who's actually controlling the military might of the United States? And they have responded by reactivating their civil defense systems. They've prepared their underground shelters in the event of a nuclear attack. They have the capacity to shelter some 30 million Russian citizens, unlike this country, which has built shelters only for the ruling class and the military. The rest of us can duck and cover.
You're absolutely right. The we're dealing with a public, speaking of public consciousness, we're dealing with a public consciousness that has been coarsened and dumbed down, and that's what makes it so difficult for rational voices and people like Ray McGovern, who knows the score and he knows how U.S. policy is made, to break through. And we have to break through. Speaking of breaking through, if I had to recommend one book, I, on my 8 months of preparation for the trip, I read a lot of books on Syria, and the one that I think is the finest is a book that is from Global Research by an Australian academic named Tim Anderson. It's called The Dirty War on Syria. And if you want balance, objectivity, honesty, thoroughness, that's the place to look. So I recommend that to everybody. Also, we were honored to have on our trip a very good British journalist named Vanessa Beely, whose website is easy to find on the Internet. And we met through her a Canadian journalist named Ava Bartlett. Both of them have been telling the truth about this situation and trying to break through, and maybe some of your listeners could check that out. There's a committee which is led by a rather famous U.S. academic called the Committee for East-West, American Committee for East-West Accord. Stephen Cohen, who is a professor at Princeton, I think, or NYU, and he is, of course, the spouse of Katrina Vandenuvel of The Nation. He's been writing excellent stuff. You can go to that website very easily on the insanity of the new Cold War. So these are also, you can check out the U.S. Peace Council, our website, our Facebook monitor, Bahman Azad is brilliant and has found, and is, we have 30,000 hits. We've gone from 3,000 hits on average per week to 30,000 hits. So I think there's reasons for hope that we can turn around U.S. public opinion, but it's going to take a much bigger effort. And the question is, do we have time? And I don't know. It depends on us, I think.
Based on your engagement with the Syrians there, did they deliver any kind of a message that they hoped you'd carry back? Did they have statements that you'd like to express to listeners?
As I mentioned, there was unified across civil society, the government, the religious community. Let me just mention an Islamic leader. He's the highest Islamic leader. He's got a title called the Grand Mufti, which to English-speaking people probably sounds a little silly, but he's the highest Islamic legal scholar in Syria. And as I said, he represents a kind of Islam that is pluralistic and inclusive. He has suffered for his views. The jihadis assassinated his son, who was a medical student at Damascus University. He's visited the U.S. frequently. He can't get in now because of visa denial. He wants to talk to the religious in the U.S. He wants to come with the Patriarch of Damascus, and the U.S. government won't let him in. But he said to us, tell the truth about Syria when you get home. And that's what we've been trying to do. It's what you're trying to do today, too. And it isn't easy. It's like rolling a boulder up a mountain. He said one very striking phrase. He says, because the ugliness of what has been unleashed in Syria, if it is not stopped here, will spread throughout the world. And a chill went down my spine when he said that. What he was talking about was this maniacal Wahhabism, you know, Muslim Brotherhood. Although that's not quite as bad as Wahhabism. This horrible anti-woman, anti-modernity, anti-reason form of Islam. And that is what's motivating these foreign fighters. And the U.S. is using it. That's what's so outrageous. It claims to be fighting terrorism, but it's using terrorism to prosecute its war against the Syrian government.
The U.S. has a long history of using terrorism to undermine nationalist democratic institutions, or even just nationalist totalitarian states, because of the imperialist designs.
I think that's true, and I'm very impressed by your knowledge of history, because mine is perhaps not as doesn't. I haven't done the reading deep into the modern U.S. foreign policy, but I'm very impressed by it. And I think
fascist
you're right on.
Christianity.
Yeah, we have to realize the historical roots of this, and if you study the history, then you won't be bamboozled by the current war propaganda. And I tell you, when I heard on Democracy Now!, I could have wept this morning when I heard the praise lavished on this filmmaker who is doing war propaganda by promoting the white helmets. And so that's the war. This battle of ideas is a battle. And I think we're beginning to turn the tide, but it's only a beginning. So we just have to keep truth-telling and speak truth to power.
And give again the website where listeners can find more about the U.S. Peace Council and the names of the two journalists that you, female journalists.
Right.
And the author of that book. I believe he's an Australian author, isn't he?
Yeah, right. Yes, the U.S. Peace Council has its own website, and it's kept current, so you can find a lot about us there. We have a Facebook page, which is being updated almost every half hour, and that's what's getting all these hits that I was boasting about a moment ago. So that's one way to find out about what we are doing, and we're very ecumenical. If somebody writes a good article, we're happy to post it. The journalist, Robert Parry, has been doing outstanding work. He was the one who spilled the beans on the Iran-Contra many years ago, Iran-Contra case. Robert Parry is writing about Syria, and it's first-rate journalism. The book is called The Dirty War on Syria by Tim Anderson, and it's available through Global Research. You can get it as a JPEG or something. You can get it electronically. It's the finest book in the field. And these two heroic journalists that I met, and who don't just report from Beirut like a lot of the establishment journalists, but who go to the war zones and talk to everybody, are Vanessa Bealey. Her website is 21stcenturywire.com. It's an independent, I think it's UK-based, but she writes widely. Her last name is spelled B-E-E-L-E-Y, Vanessa, and Google that name and you surely get it. And then the Canadian journalist, who I'm less familiar with, but who I met on the trip, is Ava Bach. And if you Google her name, you'll find her websites and her writing.
Joe, can you repeat Ava's last name? There's a little problem with your phone or somebody's phone, and it cut out.
Okay, sure. Bartlett, B as in boy, A, R, T as in toy, L, E, T, T. Bartlett. Thank you for allowing me to rant on and on.
You know what? It wasn't a rant. I'd say it was a report back that language is key to the control mechanisms that some human beings use to manipulate others. And to see what you've just done as a rant, I think, is part of that control mechanism, because it undermines the significance of your trip, your observations, your report back, and your commitment to empower people, to give agency in a time when most people on this planet have no agency at all. Americans, to the extent that we have any agency, control over our government, which we pay for and theoretically is a democratic one, responding to the demands, the values, the aspirations of its citizens, to the extent that they have any agency, it's dependent on your kind of report back, your firsthand witness, and your, I'd say, tireless efforts to change the tide that people like Hillary and others are directing the country towards.
Well, thank you for those kind words, and thanks to your radio station for being an outlet for the views of ordinary people. And I wish we had you in New York.
Well, I can't promise you
any money.
I'll need a place to crash.
The same zero, but still, we would love to have you in New York.
Since my son moved out of Brooklyn, I need a place to crash next time I show up for a conference.
And you got a place in my house.
Okay, thanks, Joe. This is WZRD Chicago, The Wizard. Okay. Take care.
Okay, thanks a lot.